for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Two suspects identified in Monday's Boston Marathon bombings have links to Chechnya. We'll be following developments as they occur throughout the morning. Former Pakistani President Musharraf is arrested in Islamabad, and divisions in Venezuela intensify after a disputed presidential election. Here in the studio for this week's roundup of international news, Yoki Driessen of The Atlantic, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, and Jeff Dyer of the Financial Times. I look forward to hearing from you this morning. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Well, welcome to all of you.
Thanks, Dan.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. Yoki Driessen, we're going to continue to follow what's happening in Boston. We know that a 20-block area of Watertown has now been locked down, closed down. Police are closing in on it, but we don't know exactly why.
Right. We don't know if they've identified the house he's in. We don't know if they've identified the block he's in. We don't know if he is wounded, which potentially is a useful piece of information, if they're trying to get him to turn himself in alive. We don't know if he's willing to die. We don't know how many bombs he has with him that are pre-made. We don't know if he had any plan to go to or if this was all improvised, as it seems to be. So there's a real, real large list of unknowns, and some of them are very important. I mean, arguably the biggest one, the biggest two, does he have accomplices who may be trying to carry out other attacks in or around Boston? Is this purely a domestic case of someone who has lived here a long time, have been radicalized, like Nidal Hassan in Fort Hood, and in other similar attacks that were carried out by people who had lived here without much problem and then suddenly turned violent? Or is this linked to any one of the number of Islamist groups still fighting in Chechnya, in Azerbaijan, in Kyrgyzstan, throughout the Caucasus? And so you've got the unknowns on the ground in Boston, and then you've got these kind of big picture, high-level unknowns.
Nancy.
I agree, and I think the other thing to be careful, though, is because there are so many unknowns, trying to figure out how much we should be tying this to some international group. This could be kids that acted out on their own. I was struck, having just come from the Middle East, as I was watching the video, they carried themselves as Americans, as Westerners. I didn't see kids who looked like they had recently immigrated. They seemed Americans. You see the friends that they've been interviewing on television, they seem to be affiliated with Americana. They seem to be very American kids. Their father now has apparently made a plea that they come forward. So they seem to be very American. And so that's what struck me at this point of the investigation.
And we have the London Marathon that's going to take place Sunday. NPR has just reported there will be extra police on board.
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing that the Boston Marathon has shown is that this type of event is, in some ways, it's the worst nightmare for the police. It's an event that's spread over across a huge city, huge crowds. There's going to be over 500,000 people usually come out to watch the London Marathon. It's almost impossible to really police an event like this to guarantee that there won't be any security threats. Having said that, I imagine that people in Britain have been very impressed by the kind of resilience and that people in Boston have shown this week, and I would have thought that they would want to show that they don't want to be deterred or intimidated by this kind of terrorist attack, and I expect the event to go ahead and be a big success.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I agree completely about the impossibility of securing 26 miles of route, but, you know, we talk about resilience. We talk about the bravery of many of the first responders, the bravery of some people who were total strangers who applied tourniquets, tried to pull people away in the immediate aftermath, but I think there's a legitimate question about the current response of shutting down and evacuating a major, major American city in response to an attack, not minimizing the number of casualties, not minimizing the severity of it, but in the scheme of things compared to 9/11, this is not an attack on that scale. And you're evacuating an entire American city. So if you're talking about a terror attack, which obviously a piece of it is to kill as many as you can, but obviously a piece of it is to disrupt a city, to terrorize in a literal sense, they've succeeded. They've shut down and evacuated an American city. So if you're another group, another radicalized person living anywhere in the U.S. thinking, what kind of attack should I do? this seems potentially very appealing because this wasn't the kind of attack that would cause necessarily the biggest number of casualties. If you want to really, I've run these kind of races before, if you really want to kill a lot of people, you bomb the starting line. When you've got thousands of people in what are called corrals, there people are packed, I mean, literally as close as we are in the studio, in this room you would have 50 or 100 people jammed shoulder to shoulder. So this was not the kind of attack that was going to kill the largest number of people, but this was the kind of attack that was going to get the attention and is now leading to the evacuation of a major city.
And, of course, having just returned from the Middle East, you have seen a lot of these.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny. I was only gone for a year, but I live in a country, I live in Cairo, where we see 50 people killed by the authorities at any given time, and the reaction there is much less than it is here. And, you know, I started thinking, is it that we value our lives here more than they do in Egypt? Is there a sense of a normal there that we're just not accustomed to? But, you know, I'm traveling with an Egyptian colleague of mine and who's in Washington for the first time, and she's stunned at the response because we're around and living in a country that's persistently unstable, where people are being terrorized, they would argue, by their governments. And so for us to see this, it's a very different experience, the level of attention and security that's given to it. And that's not to say one is better or worse. It's not for me to make that judgment. But the difference in reaction for me is very startling, having just left Cairo a couple weeks ago.
What about the attention paid to Margaret Thatcher's funeral?
That was obviously another event that was a huge crowd, potential and a vulnerability. But again, as Yoki said, you have to keep on carrying on living your life. You can't police these kinds of – you can't expect to reduce all security risk of these kinds of events. You have to carry on. You can't let these type of events just grind everything to a halt.
But surely, Jeff, there were huge numbers of authorities in presence during that parade, if you will.
Absolutely, there were. But then if you talk to counterterrorism officials, they'll always say that the best chance you have to catch anyone who's going to do something at these events is not by having policemen on the spot watching for suspicious bags or suspicious individuals. It's about the pre-intelligence and keeping an eye on suspicious groups and monitoring their activities and who they're talking to. And it's all the counterintelligence activities that take place before an event that give you the best chance of catching someone.
And extraordinarily after the event with his camera in Lord and Taylor.
I mean, I find this just almost mind-blowing. You know, the last time I've seen, I think we've seen any kind of indication of how advanced countries have become in facial recognition was after an Israeli team assassinated a Hezbollah leader in Dubai. And within a day and a half, they had photos of everyone involved in it. They had the faces identified, the identities attached. It was easy to forget because we're sitting here in the U.S. But now you're seeing that here. I mean, think about not only the number of pictures, but the same person being photographed from 20, 50 different angles. And to identify these guys, to watch them walking in, it's incredible to me.
Extraordinary.
Well, I think what was shocking is that knowing the kind of technology that's out there, even if they know the precise detail of it, that they would walk around so openly, so brazenly. I mean, in the Middle East, we're used to it in the sense that everybody's carrying cell phone cameras. But so there is an awareness around the world that you're being photographed at any time. And the idea that someone, as they're alleged to have done, would put down a backpack with an explosive in it and not in any way try to conceal who he is or who he's affiliated with in this attack, I think has been just as shocking as the detail of the photos themselves.
Yeah.
It is. It's a different era for policing now. I mean, before, if you've been the witness to an event like this, the police would ask you to write down a statement. Now they want to see your iPhone. The police in Massachusetts were stopping people at Logan Airport over the last few days and asking to look through their telephones to see if they had any images from the scene. So it's a very different era of how you investigate crimes in the era of the iPhone.
And that is the voice of Jeff Dyer. He is foreign policy correspondent with the Financial Times. Nancy Youssef, she's Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Yoki Driessen is now contributing editor for The Atlantic and writer in residence at the Center for a New American Security. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Yoki, there is other news out there. Let's talk about North Korea and what North Korea is demanding before restarting talks with the U.S. and South Korea.
And frankly, what they're demanding is almost as bizarre and unreasonable as flying Dennis Rodman in to watch a staged basketball game. I mean, they're demanding an end to all U.S. South Korean military cooperation, military training. They're demanding the withdrawal of many, if not all, of the U.S. military assets from South Korea. They're demanding an end, an immediate end, and lifting of all U.S. and U.N. sanctions. So they're basically asking that the U.S. withdraw completely, in substance, if not totally technically, from South Korea, which is never going to happen. And they're demanding that as a precondition. The part of it that anybody who's trying to find even the slightest glimmer of hope amidst all the bluster, this talk about, you know, a sledgehammer that's going to destroy South Korea, the typical kind of North Korean bravado, is that there's a willingness to talk. So the people who are trying to look and see anything in this that has sunlight, that's what they point to.
Nancy.
That's right. I mean, after weeks of bombastic rhetoric from Pyongyang, at least there's some discussion of talk, which I think, in light of how quickly this had escalated and how much instability and anxiousness it had created on the Korean Peninsula, I think for many people this is a sign of hope and hopefully a way for the North Korean leader to somehow walk out of this situation, get himself off, and perhaps he could come out and say, look at the Americans, they're begging for me to back down, in light of the fact that Kerry proposed his own conditions for talks that he backed down. So perhaps this is laying the groundwork for Kim Jong-un to walk out of the situation.
Nancy Youssef, Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Short break here. When we come back, we'll give you an update on what's happening in Boston and if there is special breaking news, we'll go to that as well. Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. But of course, we are following developments in Boston, where a million people, it is said, are locked down. Boston itself is deserted, looks like a ghost town, because there is active police activity in Watertown, where a 20-block area has been cordoned off. Here in the studio, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, Jeff Dyer, a foreign policy correspondent with the Financial Times, and Yoki Driessen, he's contributing editor for The Atlantic and writer-in-residence at the Center for a New American Security. Jeff Dyer, I didn't give you a chance to talk about North Korea. Is Pyongyang still positioning for a missile test firing?
It is possible that they will conduct this missile test in the next few days. It is also possible, as Nancy was saying, that Kim Jong-un has found a way to sort of back down from this current crisis, that he will declare when the U.S.-South Korean military exercise is over, he will declare that North Korea has triumphed again, that he's resisted the, you know, aggressive intentions of the imperialist Americans, and once again he's stood up for proud North Korea. And that will give him a way of backing down from this current crisis. But beyond that, it's very hard to see a way forward, because as Yoki was saying, North Korea's demands are completely unacceptable. But from the North Korean point of view, what America wants is completely unacceptable as well. America wants the North Korea to accept in negotiations about giving up its nuclear weapons.
So
and everything they've said is that they're going to go on and persist and keep on going on with their nuclear weapon development program.
And how active is China likely to be?
Well, that's the big question. There are two things about China's attitude towards North Korea. The first of that, their policy towards North Korea is the single most controversial part of their foreign policy within the country. There are very senior people within the country who think it's a disastrous strategy to be so close to North Korea, who would love to change the policy, who find it almost humiliating that China is backing this disgraceful dictatorship. On the other hand, the second thing you need to know is that the policy is not going to change in any substantial way. The Chinese leadership looks at North Korea and thinks if anything really changed there, it would be a huge amount of instability, huge amounts of risks, which is precisely the things they don't want to see. However, at the margins, it is possible that China would apply some pressure against North Korea, maybe cut off some of their oil supplies. Indeed, maybe that's what's been happening this week. Maybe one of the reasons why we haven't seen this missile test is that China has been subtly squeezing them. We don't know. But don't expect anything dramatic from the Chinese.
That's a great point. And we were expecting a test this week for the anniversary of the founder's birthday, and that didn't happen. It's also worth noting that the U.S. exercise ends at the end of the month, and so that might be a point where we'll sort of see a speech from Kim Jong-un. One of the things to remember, I think, which is hard for us in the United States to be aware of, is North Koreans are really cut off from the kind of information that we have, and so he can really control the narrative and let in as much as he wants about what the U.S. is saying or what the U.S. is offering and sort of limit their understanding and can really control this message of saying the Americans came begging to me and I turned them down and I've solved this crisis. And so I think a lot of people will be watching for the end of the month when the U.S. exercises are scheduled to. And the potential is that he'll come out and say, look at the Americans, they've left, they've stopped their exercises, because there's no way that average North Koreans would know that those exercises were scheduled to end. And so there's an opportunity for him to talk his way, if you will, out of this.
Yoki, let's talk about Pakistan and Musharraf Pervez. Musharraf fled an Islamabad courtroom on Thursday when a judge revoked his bail. What's this all about?
It's interesting. Yesterday, trending on Twitter about this particular thing was that this was Pakistan's O.J. Simpson moment, because there was these crazy still photos and videos of Musharraf after having been basically told by this judge that he'd committed treason and would be charged under the treason laws, getting back into an armored SUV. His security guys, kind of one of them was perched on the SUV and then sort of roaring off into the distance. There were cameras following him. I mean, the basic question here, it's an interesting one, dates back to a fight between him and the judges who now want to put him on trial. He disbanded the Supreme Court. He tried to put the judiciary totally under his own control. This was near the end of his time in power. And now the judges are having their revenge. The legal system of Pakistan is trying to say to him, no, you can't do this to us. We are a valid institution. We're an institution that has legitimacy. And we're going to hold you accountable for what you tried to do to us. I'm not trying to suggest this is just a personal, beef between a judge and a former dictator. But it's an interesting power struggle between one who tried to put the other under his heel and now the other pushing back and saying, we're not going to let you do that.
What's extraordinary is that he came back to Pakistan. I mean, he was living in exile in Dubai and London for 5 years from the time that he was pushed out of office, in part because of this controversy in which he forced the judges to live under house arrest, which led to protests and eventually his fall. He seemed to have this idea that he could run in elections next month, and then he was disqualified from that. There seemed to be warnings that he wasn't as popular as he seemed to think he was. And he, up until the judges spoke, he seemed to think that his bail would not be revoked. And as Yoki said, that he was literally fleeing on live television. And I think that's the most extraordinary thing. So it's puzzling that he even returned back and thought that he could avoid all this. The other interesting thing is what the role of the army will be, because he's a former four-star general and he had a very close relationship with the army, and the question will be whether the army will intervene on behalf of their sort of former ally or whether they'll let the sort of legal system play out. And so all of this suggests that his actions are really disrupting an already fragile country on the brink of elections next month.
Yeah.
It is, as I said, an extraordinary event to see someone in a courthouse of being put under arrest and to just walk out of that courthouse in front of all sorts of police. But as Nancy was saying, it's also extraordinary in the context of Pakistan that the former head of the army, former president, would be facing this type of legal challenge as well. So it's a potentially hugely destabilizing moment in the country.
All right. I'd like to hear about Venezuela's election because there is a good bit of controversy, dispute over the voting. Maduro apparently won. He was Chavez's handpicked successor, but in fact, it was a close election. Nancy.
1.8 percentage points, 260,000 votes separated him and his opponent in a country of 26 million. And it's extraordinary for a number of reasons. This was, as you mentioned, Hugo Chavez's selected heir apparent. And what was really at stake is not only Venezuela, the presidency, but really with the direction of Venezuela itself, because under Hugo Chavez, there was a closer alliance with China and Russia and Iran, and his opponent was really proposing a more American sort of alliance. And so the fact that he won narrowly speaks to how polarized Venezuela is. He is supposed to be inaugurated today. There are talks of an audit that will happen of the election results, but the week has led to 8 killed because of disputes over this election.
All right, and here's an update from NBC that the uncle of the two brothers suspected in the bombing at the Boston Marathon is telling NBC, "We are Muslims, we're ethnic Chechens. Somebody radicalized them." It's an interesting statement from the uncle. All right, I carry on with Venezuela.
I mean, what just in the last half day, you had Maduro being inaugurated. He's now the president-elect of, and arguably the president of Venezuela. You just had, in the last several hours, an announcement they're going to audit every vote. And the reason this matters is they had previously audited about 54%. His challenger had said that he would overcome that margin if they audited the last 46%. So you get down to this number game. It's like when we've got Karl Rove with his whiteboard on election night here. But they're arguing that with a margin that slim, if you go back through this other basically half of the votes, he's arguing he'll overcome the margin. Who knows? But it is interesting.
All right. I'm going to take a caller right now who'd like to ask about Venezuela. Phil in Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I was just calling because my girlfriend is actually from Venezuela. She emigrated with her family to the U.S. after the 2002 coup, and she was showing me on Facebook pictures from her friends and family down there of what looked like police officers or military people with stacks of white, like bundled up white paper with ANC on the side, which is the National Electoral Council, and they were looked like it was the disposing of them or whatnot. And her friends and family were saying that they were, you know, people getting rid of it, making it impossible to do a hand recount of any kind, and that was not possible. And I was wondering if your panel had heard anything about it, and if maybe this relates to why Secretary Kerry said that the State Department was not ready to recognize the election yet.
All right. Yogi.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, those photos are circulating. There are similar videos. There are videos of police and army guys sort of leading people in to vote more than once. As someone from Chicago, it reminds me of the old joke about Chicago that you just keep voting until they tell you to stop. But that is why the U.S. is one of the few countries that has not recognized this victory. They have not said he is the president. They have not said this election is over. So I think the caller, I think Phil is exactly right in terms of the reason for it and what's happening on the ground.
I agree. I would add, though, the other thing that's at stake for the United States is really the future of Venezuela, both economically and politically, because his opponent is someone who's much more pro-American, much more likely to work with the United States than the heir apparent to Hugo Chavez, and I think that's at stake as well. And so I think that's a contributing factor in terms of why the United States hasn't recognized the president, and there are reports of Ahmadinejad, for example, flying to the inauguration, and I think that's worth pointing out.
I think, assuming that Maduro is confirmed as the president, he's still going to face an incredibly difficult situation. The economy is in a really tough bind. Inflation's at 30%. They have a budget deficit that's around 15% of GDP. The crime rate is incredibly high. Violent crime is incredibly high in Venezuela. There are shortages of basic domestic goods. So he faces a whole lot of economic challenges that he needs to resolve. But on the political front, because he has such a weak mandate, he's also in a very weak position. He's going to face a lot of opposition, not just from Capriles and the formal opposition, but from within Chavismo as well. The sort of number two within Chavismo movement is the president of the National Assembly, who came out and gave a statement saying that this is a moment for profound self-criticism. So he's going to face a lot of opposition from within his own political movement too. So the economics are going to push him to be much more pragmatic to try and solve some of these problems. But the politics might push him to radicalize, to try and show the broader Chavismo movement that he is the legitimate heir to Hugo Chavez.
So what do you mean by radicalize?
Radicalize could mean more nationalizations, it could mean more economic measures, it could mean more rhetoric about the West and about the US, and it could also mean a very aggressive stance against the opposition, particularly if Capriles starts to launch demonstrations in the streets against the election result.
Jeff Diary, he is foreign policy correspondent with the Financial Times, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The uncle of the suspects has asked that his nephew turn himself in and ask for forgiveness. His name is Ruslan Sarny. And let's go now to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Michelle, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
I just had a minor correction of something I think Yoki Driesen said earlier in the show, which was that the search for the bomber that's currently underway in Boston has caused the evacuation of a major American city. I think, in fact, it's a shelter-in-place situation, which is the opposite of an evacuation.
I think that's a fair point, especially in parts like in Waterston, where there is the search. But the footage today from downtown Boston, they've shut down every major rail. The Boston T has been shut down. There are no buses into downtown Boston.
No overflights.
There's no flights. I mean, so I would stand by what I said. If you look at the footage from downtown Boston, it's a ghost town. As you said before, it's empty. There is shelter in place in other areas of the city where they think this guy may be held up. The police said, stay away from your windows, lock your doors. Downtown Boston is largely emptied out because you can't get into it even if you wanted to.
All right, to Chevy Chase, Maryland. Good morning, Ernest.
Good morning. I just wanted to add to the discussion that although this computer technology of facial recognition and so forth is absolutely fantastic in crime-solving, that old-fashioned sleuthing really might have broken this case. Today's Washington Post had a short article on page A10. The British press had longer articles all over the place that bombing victim Jeff Bauman, the guy from New Hampshire who lost both legs, after he came out of surgery in the hospital, he asked for pen and paper and wrote the words, bag, I saw the guy right in the eyes. And he provided the FBI a full description of what he saw, so they knew ahead of time exactly what to look for when they sorted through those, hundreds and thousands of hours of videotapes. So I think although the technology is great, we can't pretend that that's a magic bullet. The whole thing sped up like it did because of excellent sleuthing and the fortunate event that Jeff Bauman survived the blast and was able to provide a description.
Ernest, I think that's such a valuable, important point to make. Someone did make that point in the first hour, the domestic hour, the news roundup, saying that this young man really wanted a pencil and paper, even though he had lost both his legs below the knee. Nancy.
I'd just like to comment about what the uncle said, that we are Muslims and that he was radicalized in some way. And perhaps because I live in the Muslim world, you know, at a time like this, I think it's particularly important to note that there's a difference between being a Muslim and being an Islamist. And that what I think he's trying to say is that please don't associate that being Muslim, that somehow that means being extremist. And I think for the Muslim community, both here and abroad, that's become a very important thing, because I think for most Muslims, when things like this are done in the name of the their faith, that that Muslims feel that their faith is in fact being hijacked. And the other interesting thing that I thought he said is the fact that he could be radicalized in the United States is a disturbing trend, because up until this point, I think there was an assumption that the radicalization of Muslims happened abroad or through foreign organizations, and that he's suggesting that that potentially happened here within our borders by someone who's raised primarily in the United States is a troubling development.
And the one tweet from Andrea Mitchell, Secretary of State Kerry, says it's inappropriate to comment about Chechnya or other hypotheticals, but terror is terror, and underscores the importance to be vigilant. Short break here, and we will be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.
And welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. But of course, we have also been following all the events in Boston and areas around Boston. Watertown is one of the areas where police had focused in on. A 20-block area was absolutely shut down. Very, very tightly. But now, Yoki, the uncle of these two young men, has been speaking to the press.
It's interesting because he appears to be speaking right outside of his house. And it's a reminder to a point that Nancy made. This is a very Americanized family. I mean, this is a man standing outside in a polo shirt. He's in what appears to be a fairly modest house, standing next to a minivan.
But he doesn't seem to have very nice things to say about his nephews, Nancy. Yeah,
the one quote I caught, they asked him what he thought led to this, and he seemed to suggest, I think he said being losers as one of the reasons that contributed to this. So I think, and I think there's a real anger from him that his family and has been associated with this, and I think he's trying to distance himself from the actions of these two, or the alleged actions of these two, and make a distinction between what they've done and what his sort of American experience is, and versus what theirs is.
I mean, he's also talking about how this is an atrocity. He condemns it as fully as he could. But then he kept saying that he knew these boys since they were kids. I mean, he said that more than once. It gets back to a point about that Nancy said before the break about radicalization. I mean, it is worth remembering that Nidal Hassan was someone who had been moderate in every part of his belief and every part of his Muslim practice. He was radicalized over the internet by Anwar al-Awlaki. The Obama administration used a drone in Yemen to kill him. He was a propagandist for al-Qaeda. The hope was you might prevent others in the U.S. from being radicalized over the internet, from downloading audio tapes. If they were, in fact, radicalized over the internet, it suggests that that didn't work, that there are other people capable of radicalizing people here, which is very scary.
All right, let's take a caller here in Washington, D.C. Hello, Melanie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
In support of what the gentleman has just said, within the last hour and a half, I listened to an NPR interview of a young intern at the Boston Globe who has been friends with the younger suspect for about 4 or 5 years. Very close friends. He had glowing things to say about this young man.
Yes, I heard the same interview, Melanie.
Yes, and also there was an interview of one of this young man's teachers from high school. I think he was a coach of his as well. He called him an absolute sweetheart. So my question or comment is related to what psychologists and law enforcement agents might do with this information, with what seems to be certainly a phenomena in our society where something like this could a change of mind could happen so quickly, and perhaps special consideration of this phenomena might lead to greater concern.
But you know what you're suggesting, Melanie, is that we have to get inside the young man's head. We have to consolidate the image of a teacher or a friend talking about this young man from their perspective, and then the actions that may be being generated from within. We have no way of knowing what goes on.
I think what they're going to try to, I completely agree. I think what they're going to try to get into now, as they try to get into his head, is his computer. I mean, they're going to try to find out who has he been talking to, what has he been saying, what language was it? Can they figure out where the person who he was talking to was based? It's worth remembering also that building IEDs, unfortunately, I mean, Nancy and I both lived overseas. We've seen the impact of them. They're very easy to build. They're very cheap. You can download on YouTube hundreds upon hundreds of videos on how to build them. So once they figure out who he spoke to, who may have radicalized him, then they'll try to figure out how did he learn how to build the bomb. But it's easily available. So I think to your point about getting to his head, it's difficult. Getting into his computer will be the focus because that's the key question.
If they can find that computer, Nancy.
I think that's a great point. I would just add what I'm personally curious about is how quickly he became radicalized. How is it that they're describing him as someone who was an all-American guy, who was very friendly, and then becomes radicalized? When did the language start to change, and who changed it, and what provoked that change? I'm really curious. How did that happen? How quickly did it happen? And did it come from a domestic source or from an international source? Was it provoked by international events that the U.S. is doing? Or was it provoked by things happening domestically or internally in his own life?
Jeff.
I think we also need to be aware that this has been a very bad week for news organizations and people in general from getting out ahead of events too quickly. And so listeners should be aware that these are just very much fragments of information that are just being made available as we're speaking. It's going to take a long time for the full picture to become available. And at the moment, we really only have questions that we want to ask rather than any real insider information as to what has motivated these two young men.
All right. And from National Harbor, Maryland. Good morning, Sam.
Hi, Diane. Good morning. I love your show. You are a national treasure.
Thank you.
I'm going a little bit extreme. I just want to say I think U.S. needs to stop immigration from Muslim countries. I am from Muslim country, super liberal, but I believe there's so much and that this will never stop.
Now, with immigration exactly on the horizon, these kinds of questions are going to come up.
are going to come up, and this is precisely the reason why we do need to take a very deep breath at the moment and find out more information about this case and not jump to too many conclusions. These are what it seems to be two young men who have been in this country for more than a decade, have been to American high schools, American colleges.
Received scholarships.
Scholarships, have friends in the community. So I think for all sorts of reasons, I don't agree with the caller, but I think it's also very important to point out that this is not just a case of someone who's just moved here from a Muslim country.
All right, to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I wanted to refer back to one of the comments that your guest made a little bit ago about the opinion that the reaction in Boston may be a little bit disproportionate to the event in terms of evacuating the city. Specifically, he made a comparison to the events of 9/11. And I think that you got to look at the situation on the ground and take the actions appropriate to the situation at hand. And I think that certainly when you look at post 9/11 and the days afterwards, shutting down all the U.S. airspace afterwards was certainly the appropriate action to take and appropriate for the types of events we're dealing with. Likewise, when you're dealing with a person at large who is committing terror on the ground, evacuating a city and shutting it down, I think, is a very appropriate action.
I think it's a valid point. I think it'll be debated in the weeks and months ahead. I mean, the counterargument, I think, is worth strongly considering is, what is the motivation fundamentally of these kind of attacks? It's to try to get as much attention as you can. It's to try to publicize whatever cause you believe you're fighting for. So we can debate, we will debate, did this dragnet work? Was it the right approach? But we also need to debate, if you give them in some ways what it is they're trying to get, do you give up? I mean, are you in some ways helping them achieve what they want to achieve by devoting this much attention, this many resources?
All right, to Merrillville, West Virginia. Nicola, you're on the air.
Yes, I love your program.
Thank you.
Thank you for staying strong in your struggle. And I have been very concerned that I haven't heard a little bit more soul-searching in that whole regard of Boston. And I've been trying to imagine what it would be like to live in a country where this type of effect is actually achieved with a drone, with something that comes out of the sky, has no rhyme or reason for the civilians that live there. And so you can't even go on a search for the perpetrator. And I'm wondering whether we shouldn't look at ourselves and say, you know, what we do to others may be done unto us.
Yeah.
Well, I think on the one hand, the caller is absolutely right to say that there should be much more reflection, discussion about the U.S. drone program and the kind of impact it is having in the countries where it's taking place and the potential for blowback to the U.S. However, again, I think we should say there's absolutely no indication whatsoever that there's any connection between that and this particular incident. And until we have more information about what motivated these two young men, why they did it, who they've been meeting with, who radicalized them, where they've been in the last few years, I think we need to be very careful about opening up that kind of discussion.
All right, to Pete in Miami, Florida. Good morning, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment about the Venezuela situation. I am from Venezuela originally, and I have relatives that worked with the Chavez government the first 5 years. But in regard to the election, I think for Venezuela to finally be able to turn the corner, it is going to have to reach rock bottom. And the only way of doing that is for Maduro to stay in power. And then the Venezuelans will learn where they made their mistakes, because there's no way. This is a de facto dictatorship, and it has been since at least, I would say, 2004, or, well, actually probably sooner than that.
All right. Jeff, do you want to comment?
Well, I think as the caller points out, I mean, however this does play out in the next few days in terms of whether Maduro is really confirmed as president, it's going to be a very, very rough period for Venezuela. There's huge economic problems developing, big political tensions. This is a country that is now divided 50-50 between two different political groupings that do seem to detest each other. It's very hard to see a sort of smooth scenario come out of this, how things are not going to get much worse quite quickly for Venezuela.
Nancy.
I would only add, I think what Pete is also raising is, if what Pete is saying is sort of the majority view, is there an argument to be made that the elections were held too soon after Hugo Chavez's death and that there wasn't really an opportunity for those who shared the vision, that, as Pete describes it, to organize and mobilize themselves such that, that there could be a clear outcome one way or the other, that, that the result of having elections so soon was to essentially leave the country polarized exactly where it's been?
To Mohammed in Brandon, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Diane Dream. My name is Mohammed. I'm a Muslim, and I am kind of disturbed with what is going on, but I do want to touch base upon a comment that was aired a few minutes ago about immigrations of Muslims to the country and what have you. Being a Muslim and living in the United States for about 10 years, I can say is that in the last 10 years, I have not heard of a constructive dialogue with Muslim community. The community has always been targeted for radicals by picking up kids from mosques and putting in FBI informants in mosques, which has never translated into confidence of Muslim community in the law enforcement and having a peaceful resolution of what has transpired. Yes, there has been a lot of things that have been going on which were not right and nobody accepts them. Yet, there is no confidence in the law enforcement that builds over time such that the Muslim community can feel at home.
Mohammed, thank you for your call and your listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Does Mohammed have a valid point, Yoki?
To a degree. I mean, I would take issue with many parts of his comment. To say one thing that I think in retrospect was an act of bravery and courage on the part of George W. Bush after 9/11 was to stress again and again and again that Muslim neighbors living in this country overwhelmingly are peaceful, that there should not be reprisals, that the religion shouldn't be tarred. I think there's actually in some ways been a sign of strength of this country as a whole, that the number of hate attacks, number of bigoted attacks, even though each one individually may be horrific, has been very limited. And that's despite fear, that's despite attacks being carried out in the name of Islam. So I would take issue with what
Nancy.
He said.
You know, having grown up in a Muslim household and been exposed to this my entire life, I have to say I'm in my 30s, and when I was growing up, even though there was discrimination, there was such gratitude for the opportunities that the United States offered that there was never any expectation of reaching out or anything, and that's just the generation that I grew up under. So it's interesting to hear that kind of expectation, because I've never grown up around that. And I would also say that the Muslim American experience, I think, is much better, having traveled all over the world, than it is in Europe, in France, and in England. And I think that really speaks to how welcoming the United States is relative to other countries in the world. So my own experience and my family's own experience has not been one of sort of an expectation of dialogue, but immense gratitude for the opportunities that the country provided that we would have never had in my native country of Egypt.
One last caller, Kevin, in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask some of the experts on your panel what their experiences were in the Middle East when, IED explosions or other types of bombing and terrorist events would take place, on a weekly basis or even more than one a week, and juxtapose the response from the law enforcement in the Boston area with what you might see in the Middle East.
Nancy.
Well, I live in the Middle East right now, and the level of violence there is obviously much higher than it is here.
Of course.
I think the biggest difference is the expectation that we as Americans have of our law enforcement responding. In Egypt, there are protests almost on a weekly basis, and in fact, there people are attacked by the police, they're tear gassed, they're shot at, there are snipers pointing at them, and so the luxury that this country has and that you can depend on your law enforcement and see them as an ally. For the last year, I've lived in a country where that's never been the expectation. And so it's a completely different experience because the perpetrators of the attack is different and who you can turn to as a resource is completely different. In Egypt, it's seen as every man on his own, particularly in the post-revolutionary period where government institutions have started to collapse in the absence of a stable state.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I think it's also worth comparing it to Israel, which has been I've lived there for several years. There was a stretch where I was hit by attacks almost every day. It's a different culture. There they pride themselves on cleaning up the horrific aftermath of a bombing and going right back to work. So when you've had – there's a bus line in Jerusalem. The same bus was hit twice. They would put another bus into service the next day. I was in very close to a pizza restaurant, a Sparrow, that was bombed. It was cleaned up, reopened within a week. It's a different culture, but that is how they react there.
And let's hope that this country does not find itself in that situation. Yoki Dries, Nancy Youssef, Jeff Dyer, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
A peaceful weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.